Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. I can go into all the details, but if government does something that they don't have the authority to do, and they spend your money on it without the authority, then that means it was fraudulently done. When the powers that they're exerting, even though they're using the force of a gun, just because they can kill you doesn't mean it's legitimate. Your death is legitimate. They've legitimately murdered you, but they're asserting fraudulent authority. And nine times out of ten, when evil is backed into a corner, evil will just, you know, they'll annihilate everybody they possibly can because the ends justify the means. So, as we move forward, we want to continue to help educate. So, we're wrapping up today on Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, and then we're going to go into the ratification debates. So, we want to help prepare you for, you know, those things that you're going to be learning that you've already learned. And this is why I, you know, need to remind you in your appeal to heaven to continue to learn and pray and act upon those things that you've learned and prayed about. Anyway, I had an interesting conversation. Don't want to dive into it, how important it is to get constitutional compliance and holding public servants accountable to that, and actually making them take oaths, making them get educated, having them take tests. And, you know, I get this kind of look from people, yeah, it's really draconian. And I go, well, come on. What profession, you know, on earth is, you know, allowed to just exist without standards? I mean, we've created standards for florists. I mean, welcome back, Tammy.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know, that's got to raise your eyebrow. Really? You have to have a certification to arrange flowers, but you don't have to have a certification or prove you know anything to be a public servant. The people who are creating the standards of profession have no standards for themselves. Folks, are you getting it? They want to make sure that they have all the leave and latitude to basically come up with any tyranny that is necessary to get them to where they want to go. So this is why we need to focus on the Constitution. We want to make sure we finally get your party. Your party, if you're working in the party central committee, you need to get that party to basically start demanding or going towards this demand for constitutional tests. Now, the Constitution forbids religious tests, but it doesn't say that you can't apply a constitutional test. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as we start focusing on the Constitution, start centering and getting them held accountable and making sure that they understand it so we can hold them more accountable, this is why you need to be running a petition campaign and calling these people out. And one of the things that you should be saying as you're talking to people is, hey, you know, we're pointing out the Constitution and how these public servants are violating it. When are we going to start having tests to make sure that we're not electing people that, you know, don't understand the Constitution? Get people to start connecting the dots, and they will see the logic and reason and go, oh my gosh, any of them that have any professional standards, any of them, and they say we don't want professional standards for politicians, they're hypocrites. They're evil, soothsaying, fork-tongue hypocrites. Because I can't imagine how a florist, you know, the only reason a florist wants to have that certificate is if they are being protected. So let's say, you know, you're FTD or something like that, and you make it, you got to have a certificate. And so they create the standards, the education. So they're making money off of it. And so,
next thing you know, they've got the School of Floral Design and all of these things in your state. And I mean, this creates this huge monster and this bureaucracy. I understand certain professions really do require, you know, education, but I think that there are some that, you know, because it's strictly subjective. Are we going to have standards for musicians? Maybe, as a matter of fact, I've always said this, and I'm going to just get out of the rat hole after saying this. I find it ironic. I find it as a paradox how musicians go ranting about communism and paying, you know, everybody getting an equal chance and a fair share of this, fair share of that. But you never see the musicians actually taking all their excessive money or taking all the money, putting it into a pool so that everybody equally gets their fair share. Why is that? Why is it that capitalism works for musicians, but it doesn't work for the rest of us? Isn't that hypocrisy? So I would say, fix yourself, Hollywood. Fix yourself, music industry. Fix yourself, entertainment industry. And that way, when you make sure that everybody, even the crummy players, because technically, musicians, entertainers, and so forth, they get paid based on their quality of their performance. But if people that are subpar, well, is their performance not equally valid as yours? And I believe that the hypocrisy will just start oozing from them and wanting them to hold. I mean, you know, all these people that are so indignant, you know, whether that's Matt Damon or, you know, even Johnny Depp, all of these people that are just, they're all critical of each other because of their political slants, what have you. And I'm going, you know what? Put your money where your mouth is. You create a socialist system for the music industry and then prove to the world how much better off we are. And maybe we'll, you know, and as we see this, and you actually do prove to us that we're all better off because of it. Because, you know, at that point, it's always going to go back towards whoever makes the, you know, whatever sells. If you can't make something that doesn't sell, then you're going to flop.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, we'll all be forced to listen to really bad stuff, watch bad movies, bad acting. But they're going to prove to us that it's better. Anyway, okay, so I'll stop there. We need to just focus on constitutional compliance. That's what it's all about. And that's one of the reasons why I am seeking, you know, to help educate people regarding the Electoral College. I'm throwing my hat in the ring. I'm open for a presidential campaign for 2028. What I'm not going to do is I'm not going to campaign at the national level. I want people. I'm seeking people to become the electors to represent G.R. Mobley for his, you know, for president. G.R. Mobley for president. Maybe make G.R. Mobley vice president if you don't want a true constitutionalist all the way there. But at least I could, you know, poke whoever's president in 2028, whoever gets elected, whatever. But the point is that we, the people, are to choose the electors. We're not supposed to be having popular elections. One of the things, and I had this conversation, I'll share it with you, because I know in your state, the attorney general is appointed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe that if a state is to be Republican in form, and we look at the exemplar of the federal government, I believe that the people should be basically voting for an elector, and that all the executive positions should either be chosen by the elector or the governor, and then the governor would make those appointments. I'm okay with the appointment process. I'm not okay with the popular vote process.
Right.
And I would see that if you actually had counties where the selection of the governor would actually come from the counties, because that's how it should be, right? Then we'll actually see, wow, okay, that's kind of interesting, that you'll actually have constitutional or very conservative governors. You'll never have these dye-in-the-wool, you know, communist running with a little Republican, you know, monogram or little button or pin on their lapel. We need to actually start holding everybody accountable. And so I find it interesting how people talk about a Republican form of government but they don't want to really embrace it. I just think sometimes people like to say, well, I'm right, but I like our government the way it is. Because there's lots of people out there that like the voter initiatives. They like democracy. And they use and support democracy. And I'm going, you know, you can't have it both ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as we're looking at the notes on the Constitutional Convention, we were just diving into this militia comments regarding some reservations that Mr. Mason had. And then there's two more comments that we're going to get into. And then we're kind of going to summarize what we've covered and then dive into the ratification debates. So we'll see if we get to the ratification debates today. But as it stands, we're on page, let me get this right here. We are on page 459. That's what I got. What do you got?
450. I don't know if it's in the right spot, but it's 458 for me.
Okay, so if you put the cursor on Mason, it should be 459. So yeah, because 458 is just right above it. But we're on Friday, the 14th of September. And it is Mr. Mason way, way down there. And I don't want to count. I mean, he's way down there to where you can see him in the navigation pane. But anyway, it's way down there. And he's actually just so many. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 from the 15th. It's more counting down. That's how far down he is. But there's been a lot of testimony. A lot of things have been pushed out. So anyway, as we dive into what Mr. Mason's going to talk about on the militias, let's go ahead.
Colonel Mason, being sensible that an absolute prohibition of standing armies in time of peace might be unsafe, and wishing at the same time to assert something pointing out and guarding against the danger of them, moved to preface the clause, Article 1, Section 8, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, etc., with the words, and that the liberties of the people may be better secured against the danger of standing armies in the time of peace. Mr. Randolph seconded the motion.
Okay, so in other words, they're trying to create some restrictions so that the federal government does not tend to have, because at this point in time, there's no mention of the states. So go ahead. What did Madison basically say?
Madison was in favor of it. It did not restrain Congress from establishing a military force in time of peace if found necessary, and as armies in time of peace are allowed on all hands to be an evil, it is well to discountenance them by the Constitution, as far as will consist with the essential power of the government on that head.
Okay, so Governor Morris basically opposed. I think this is where we kind of left off. So go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. Mr. Governor Morris opposed the motion as setting a dishonorable mark of distinction on the military class of citizens.
Now, Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Bedford concurred with the opposition on the question. So they kind of did a vote, and they didn't like it. It was voted down. Virginia was the only one, and Georgia, those are the only states that actually said yes. So Mr. Mason then made a new move to do something different. Let's go ahead.
So Colonel Mason moved to strike out from the clause, Article 1, Section 9, no bill of attainder nor any ex post facto law shall be passed, the words, nor any ex post facto law. He thought it would not sufficiently clear that the prohibition meant by this phrase was limited to cases of a criminal nature, and no legislature ever did or can altogether avoid them in civil cases.
Okay, so Mr. Gary, the motion, but I guess he seconded the motion is what it says there, but that's up in the title, seconded the motion, but with a view to extend the prohibition to civil cases, which he thought ought to be done. Now, I disagree because I believe that when the state actually, let's say they start making a law regarding the ability for you to dig new wells. Let's say your well runs dry on your property and says, well, you know what, we're not going to allow you to dig new wells on your property. Technically, if they did that, that would be an ex post facto law. Mm-hmm. A bill of attainder or bill of punishment, which is what they're talking about here, is a bill, a law that they pass that would say, if you don't take the vax, in other words, if you're a class of people that have a conscience and you didn't get vaccinated, then you can't go into these buildings. You can't have access. The creating a basically punishing a class of people for their choices or what they've done. Now, technically, if you've taken the vaccine, then you're protected from that whatever, from those people that didn't take the vaccine. And so you don't need to be protected. That's why you took the vaccine. The people that chose not to take the vaccine, you know, they're the ones that have to live with the consequences of not being protected. So why is it that we would actually create a protection of the people who are protected and punish those people who didn't? That right there is why it is a bill of punishment, not a bill. It's a bill of attainder or punishment, not a legitimate, lawful bill that actually supports, you know, government's functions of protecting health or anything else. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So on the question that all the states were no, okay, well, that failed again. So they moved to insert declaration, quote, that the liberty of the press should be inviolable observed. Mr. Sherman came back and said, it is unnecessary. The power of Congress does not extend to the press. So on the question, it passed on the negative. In other words, they agreed with Mr. Sherman. It's not necessary because that's what they ended up putting into the Bill of Rights. They didn't want to actually delegate anything for Congress to be able to make laws or anything like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to skim all the way down to on September 15th on Saturday. We're going to go way down to Mr., well, it says Gary, but, and actually this isn't highlighted, so I'm going to go ahead and highlight this. And this is the Amendment Protection Clause. And so we're going to kind of go through the next few of these. And let me see here. Move to strike, three-fourths. Okay. And I think at this point, we'll just read all the way down to where they finally take a vote on the motions at the bottom, and I'll read ahead. But let's just highlight all of this as the Amendment Protection Clauses. So go ahead with Mr. Gary on this part on Article 5.
Mr. Gary moved to insert that.
Well, actually, so no, it's. Okay, move to insert, then Article 4, Section 4 is the paragraph underneath that. So let's just start with Article 5, because this is where they're going through and cherry-picking, because now the Constitution is finally formed into a 7 articles, and they're going through it, and they're making some moves to change this, to change that. So even though they've debated many of these issues over and over and over and over again, they're still trying to finalize the final wording and or, you know, adding or taking away from some of the meanings of what's in the Constitution. So go ahead.
The Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem necessary, or on the application of 2/3 of the legislature of the several states, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part thereof, and the same shall have been ratified by 3/4 at least of the legislatures of the several states, or by conventions in 3/4 thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress, provides that no amendment which may be made prior to the year of 1808 shall in any matter affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of Article 1.
Okay, so this is the first time that this really starts taking form, the amendment protection clauses. And so the special highlight in blue that I have, that I just created, provided that no amendment which shall be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of Article 1. Now, this is something that just got injected. Now, Mr. Sherman actually starts, you know, responding, and I find it interesting that, you know, well, let's just keep going. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Sherman expressed his fears that 3/4 of the states might be brought to do things fatal to particular states, as abolishing them altogether or depriving them of their equality in the Senate. He thought it reasonable that the proviso in facto of the states importing slaves should be extended so as to provide that no state should be affected in its internal police or deprived of its equality in the Senate.
Okay, so now he's adding. So let's look at the origins of these two gentlemen. Gary is from Massachusetts. They're not concerned with equal protection from the other states because they're one of the leading states in population. They're a big state. Even though physically they're small, they have a dominance in population. So he didn't care about that, for adding this. But Mr. Sherman, he kind of, you know, liked it a little bit. But what he wanted to do was he wanted to actually add in to make sure that the equality of the suffrage for the state legislature in the Senate was preserved, that an amendment couldn't touch it either. Okay, so Colonel Mason, then go ahead.
Colonel Mason thought the plan of amending the Constitution exceptionable and dangerous, as the proposing of amendments is in both the modes to depend, in the first immediately and in the second ultimately, on Congress. No amendments of the proper kind would ever be obtained by the people if the government should become oppressive, as he verily believed would be the case.
Okay. Now, Governor Morris and Mr. Gary, go ahead.
We moved to amend the article so as to require a convention on application of 2/3 of the states.
Okay. So they basically, now they've got this move to changing Article 5. Now, at this point, the amendment protection, they haven't touched yet. So let's go ahead. Madison then speaks up on the move.
Yeah. Mr. Madison did not see why Congress would not be as much bound to propose amendments applied for by 2/3 of the states as to call a convention on the like application. He said no objection, however, against providing for the convention for the purpose of amendments, except only that difficulties might arise as to the form, the quorum, etc., which in constitutional regulations ought to be as much as possible avoided.
Okay, so the motion of Morris and Gary was agreed to without contest, but you could see Madison was a little bit concerned about conventions. He was not a fan of the Constitutional Convention. He was a fan of the way the amendment process has worked so far. He did not, and as a matter of fact, the language for the convention was taken out, and then it was brought back in later on. Okay, so Mr. Sherman then moved to strike out. I'll do this. Mr. Sherman then moved to strike out Article 5 after legislatures. And so we're going into break. So at this point, we'll come back and I'll do Mr. Sherman. And then I'll kind of glance forward to find out what more, because the state suffrage is really critical here. So we'll be right back, because that's what they need to add. They wanted to make sure that the state legislature would have control over the voting in the Senate to some degree. So we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get back into this. So Sherman moved to strike out of Article 5 after legislatures, the words of three-fourths. And so after the word conventions, leaving future conventions to act in this manner, like this present convention, according to circumstances. Now, under the Articles of Confederation, because we've already covered this, folks, earlier this year, the Articles of Confederation had the entire conventions left to the states. If there was to be a convention, the states needed to just go form it and pay for it. They basically needed to do it themselves. Now, putting it into the Constitution makes it regulatable and controllable by the federal government. Does that not make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So what the Convention of State folks don't tell you is that the jurisdiction of the convention is federally controlled because it is in their constitution. So when Congress, when they actually create the two-thirds, Congress, whoever's controlling Congress at the time, can actually come along and say, we're going to grant your convention, and these are the rules we're going to set up. And they will set up rules to favor whatever it is that they want. Which means that this concept that this is an autonomous convention, that the states have full control, no. It's been cleared under Article 3. The Supreme Court clearly has control over all things arising under this Constitution. And Congress has basically assumed powers over everything that they've just deemed fit for themselves, but not fit by the Constitution. Transportation, health, and so forth. What makes anybody think that this convention would actually be sacred and separate from the federal government control? Why would anybody think that? If you know and understand that there's nothing under the sun that the federal government will not try to control, boy, this is in the Constitution. They can literally control this. Does that not make sense?
They have the authority to.
Right. Okay. So on this motion, it was kind of divided in Massachusetts. Yay, yay. No. So it didn't carry. Mr. Gary moved to strike out the words "or by convention in three-fourths thereof," and on this meant it still didn't carry. So they were still having problems. Now, so they weren't making any changes. But interestingly enough, Mr. Sherman then comes back with this. Go ahead.
Mr. Sherman moved according to his idea above, expressed to annex the end of the article, a further proviso that no state shall without its consent be affected in its internal police or deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Okay. So the interesting thing is that they wanted to make sure that the internal policing of the state couldn't be co-opted by the federal government. But technically, in Article 1, Section 8, they had already granted to the federal government the ability to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. That is policing in the state. To suppress insurrections, policing in the states. And repelling invasions, policing in the states. So Madison then basically goes and he says, begin with this special provisio and every state will insist on them for every boundaries, exports, etc., on the motion of Mr. Sherman. So then they basically voted for it and no. Only Connecticut said yes. Now Mr. Sherman then moved to strike out Article 5 altogether. Mr. Beerley seconded the motion on which no, no, yes, yes, no, 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 no. So the two yeses didn't get it over. So they were keeping Article 5. And then, go ahead, I'll let you read the next two, or the next few. Go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to annex a further proviso that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. This motion being dictated by the circulating murmurs of the small states was agreed to without debate, no one opposing it or on the question saying no.
Okay. All right. So then Colonel Mason,
expressing his discontent at the power given to Congress by a bare majority to pass navigation acts, which he said would not only enhance the freight, a consequence he did not so much regard, but would enable a few rich merchants in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston to monopolize the staples of the southern states and reduce their value perhaps 50%, moved a further proviso that no law in nature of navigation act be passed before the year 1808 without the consent of 2/3 of each branch of the legislature.
Okay. So on this motion, basically it didn't pass as far as these changes. But what we did see, and as we kind of come down a little further, and I believe it is on, let me see here. Yeah, so on the 17th, Monday the 17th, what actually went into the Constitution was these two provisios or these two amendment protections, because bottom line, it was agreed upon throughout the convention that there was this contention with slavery, that there was this temporary allowance, and they put that into the Constitution, so they was able to inject the amendment protection clause that would guarantee the shutdown of the slave trade in 1808, so that no amendment could pass that could touch that, to negate that. So guaranteed that the slave trade would be shut down. Now, they wanted to make another amendment for the other major contended issue in the convention, was the protection of the sovereignty of the states and the state legislatures to be able to have their sovereignty over their states. And so they inserted this amendment protection clause to guarantee that the states would not lose their equal suffrage. When I say states, that means state legislatures. So the state legislatures would not lose their suffrage because the state legislatures at that point in time were the ones appointing them. And at that point in time, they were the ones that were directing specifically. So when we look at the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment wasn't trying to create a unicameral system. It maintained a bicameral system that only changed the manner in who, how they were chosen, how they were selected, and how they were replaced. That's it. So in other words, the state suffrage did not change. It wasn't going to the people. The state suffrage was still with the state legislature, not the people of the state. So therefore, they laid this out. And today, folks, I am absolutely baffled at why state legislatures are not trying to make political hay out of this and calling all of these guys out and basically running aggressive campaigns to take back their Senate and actually creating the laws necessary. They don't even want to do that. Everybody is afraid to hold the federal government and go after the Senate. I don't get it. So because our state legislature is willing to live with the corruption, all of the state legislature, we need to start focusing on these really dark red states. They complain about not having suffrage. So let's see them put their money where their mouth is. Right. And let's see. OK, you're complaining, but you're not doing anything. You're not demanding it. You can demand it. Go demand it. Mm-hmm. And that's the point right there. So as we move forward and we're getting to September 17th, and we are literally at the point of signing the Constitution, on page 471, there is this little thing I wanted to get into with Mr. Gorham, and it's highlighted, so you should see this, right? You see it highlighted? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so let's read those right there. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Gorham said if it was not too late, he could wish for the purpose of lessening objections to the Constitution that the clause declaring the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 40,000, which had produced so much discussion, might be yet reconsidered in order to strike out 40,000 and insert 30,000. This would not, he remarked, establish that as an absolute rule, but only give Congress a greater latitude, which could not be thought unreasonable.
Okay. So Mr. King and Mr. Carroll seconded and supported the idea of Mr. Gorham. Now the president rose. This is George Washington. Okay, so now read the words of George Washington.
For the purpose of putting the question, he said that although his situation had hitherto restrained him from offering his sentiments on questions depending in the House, and it might be thought ought now to impose silence on him, yet he could not forbear expressing his wish that the alteration proposed might take place. It was much to be desired that the objections to the plan recommended might be made as few as possible. The smallest of the proportion of representatives had been considered by many members of the convention an insufficient security for the rights and interests of the people. He acknowledged that it had always appeared to himself among the exceptionable parts of the plan, and late as the present moment was for admitting amendments, he thought this of so much consequence that it would give much satisfaction to see it adopted.
Okay, so no opposition was made to the proposition of Mr. Gorham, and it was agreed to unanimously. So on the question to agree to the Constitution enrolled in order to be signed, it was agreed to, and the states answered yay, all yay. So then they went through the very last, I'll just say, political positioning and posturing and so forth. And this is all worth reading. But the reason we just highlighted that part, first off, Washington didn't say anything in any of these debates. This was the first time Washington basically said, I want you to favor this outcome instead of that. And he, you know, he influenced it. There wasn't a lot of debate over it when it actually came up on the last day as, you know, I'd like to change this from 40,000 to 30,000. Boom. Done. The language as such, remember, we talked about this early on in Madison's notes here in the convention, that early on in the convention, they wanted to leave Congress or the legislature the ability to decide, you know, what that number was going to be. Let them just regulate the number as they saw fit, which is what we have today. That language was removed so that they didn't have the ability, which is why in the Bill of Rights, the very first amendment that never was ratified, well, actually it was ratified, but Connecticut didn't do it right, so that's why we're not dealing with this today. As we look at this amendment that would have incrementally changed representation based on the numbers in the House to, you know, step forward to step forward, step forward, because the states rejected it, the states wanted to maintain 30,000 people for a representative, regardless of the cost. The whole point that Madison was doing to actually incrementally increase it was to keep the cost of the growth of government down so that they wouldn't have to build a new capital when the population got to of such where that there just wasn't enough seats anymore for the representatives. Today, based on, you know, the census and everything else, I would say 280, just to be fair, to about 280 Americans, persons, that they would be representing. So if we go to 280 million, right? And we divide that by 30,000, then that would give us 9,333. There'd be that many representatives. Now, if that 280 million was divided by 50 instead of 30, had Madison's amendment gone through, I did times, actually, so that was a bad number. Multiplying that by that number, that's not a good thing to do. So 50,000 would have created 5,600. Now, everybody has a problem because government gets too big, right? Well, let's look at the whole process when it came down to choosing the president. How were things to be done? Well, it would be done by the electors, but if the electors couldn't do it, it would be done by the House. And when they really looked at the best way to do that, they basically stated that the House of Representatives would vote by delegation, which means that it doesn't matter how many legislators you have in your state. If you only get one vote as a state for determining, in other words, kind of making it like the, even though the representatives represent the people, it would be very similar to the state legislature on, you know, how they vote, other than the fact of the creation of laws and those types of things would be based upon their constituents. It would literally come down to a single vote, so that when a bill was passing in through the House of Representatives, going in and going through the process, it would only require 26 states to vote for it, instead of allowing a popular vote to vote for it. Why is it that in choosing the president, they created a delegation vote, but most everything else was just basic popular vote? Now, this goes down to a theory and this concept of actually having an election system and a voting system that would be completely auditable. Everybody would be able to see their vote, and they would actually be able to see how their vote is standing. Well, that's exactly how I voted, and how the outcome doesn't change. That means everybody could, if there was one person that said, my vote's wrong, I did not vote that way, then that would create suspect, right? Say, all of a sudden, okay, we need to audit this. And so there needs to be a clarity. Oh, well, that person, their device, the application, they got hacked, what have you. Then they'd be able to find that out and go, okay, let's get rid of the virus, get rid of the hack, get rid of that, you know, whatever that caused that problem, and, you know, fix the problem and move forward. Because if it happened to one, it would have happened to many. Because usually when they, you know, when you get a program to actually do something, unless you create an algorithm to only do it every one of three, you know, one out of three or something like that, to where it's not consistent 100% across the board. That's how they get sneaky, because they only take a little sampling and pervert the outcome of that by a little sampling. And but a little sampling or by this little minority, one out of three, if it's one out of three applied all the way across, that's 30%. That's increasing it by 30% into an outcome, changing the outcome. So What are the odds of that actually having an effect? I think you'd actually see very negative effects coming out of those types of elections. So having a system that is fully, if it is not auditable, folks, we do not have an honest system. And when I say if it's not auditable by the people, if you can't go and look at your vote and actually see how it was being tallied in the entire process to where that outcome is a basic formula of how many people voted for this and how many people voted for that. In other words, it doesn't need to be in a, you know, an application. A spreadsheet would do it just fine. Because all you got to do is examine the formula. If the formula is just basic math, then there's no, I mean, you can hide things in applications. You can hide things in scripts. I know. That's how we get hacked. But on a basic addition, you know, spreadsheet, basic math, it's foolproof. There is the ability to for somebody to go in and play with the numbers. But bottom line, I'm just telling you that this would be the most foolproof way, because even if they played with the numbers, we'd catch that. I mean, because the numbers wouldn't be right. Because something would be wrong. Either the formula was wrong, and because we'd catch it. Believe me, if it's in a spreadsheet and you're looking and you actually do all the due diligence and say, yeah, look, that the numbers and the math is right. There's nobody complaining. I think that's the way to go. And I honestly believe that we can create a system that could easily do that. Easily do that at the state level or at the county level. Let the counties do it. If the counties don't want the state to manage the elections of the state, then the counties can do it. Yeah. And, you know, in the old days, the counties did do it. And the only thing that the states did in the federal elections is they chose the time, place, and manner of where the elections were to be done. The manner, you know, via voice, via ballot, what have you. But it was executed by the counties, period. It wasn't executed by the state or the federal government. Anyway, so we got 6 minutes left. Any questions or what are your comments and what do you think about the convention and going through this? Is there anything that you learned that you liked or anything that stood out?
No, I'm just continually reminded of how complex it was.
Oh, the process, but, yeah.
Yeah, it just amazes me that they actually came to a conclusion with all the different minds in there. Something that was good and legitimate.
Okay, so let's be honest, though. The way this worked, they came out with a common outcome. But everybody left there with frustrations because what they wanted, there are certain things that they may have wanted they didn't get. Right? Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, however the masses, this actually speaks to Madison, because Madison was the guy that had a plan and his plan was rejected. And the person that actually comes up with an idea and doesn't go down defending it and actually become a diehard, you know, naysayer and all of that, is the common man. I mean, who doesn't do that? I deal with people all the time where, you know, they come up with an idea or something and they start defending it like it's their baby. And it's just a bad idea. We talked about this before, why, you know, people throw things up on the wall and actually, you know, it just falls to the floor real quick, you know, and they start getting frustrated. Well, you don't like me. You don't like my idea. No, your ideas just suck. Yeah. Work on your ideas.
But I think it's important also to recognize that there's a lot of people screaming, oh, the Republicans just need to get along. Well, they didn't get along. They argued extensively.
Right. Yeah, they did, but at the end of the day, the final outcome was the final outcome. And that's what was it, you know, whether they liked it or not, they accepted it. So, as we kind of look at the convention, was there anything that you found illuminating, you know, any of the processes, the language, the struggles, anything?
I mean, I think we need to reiterate the point that, you know, the government does have control over a convention. So that is an enumerated power that they're given.
Right. Absolutely. So when you start understanding those types of principles, then it's really hard to refute whether it's enumerated or not. If it's enumerated, they have jurisdiction. If it's not, abortion, religion, life, health care, housing, labor. There's so many things that there is not enumerated in that Constitution that they're assuming. They're spending money on. Even when we look at how they have expanded the role of the Department of Defense and how they've expanded the enforcement agencies of all these bureaucracies. I mean, all of these things are not enumerated. And yet they're spending money at breakneck speed. Do we have a tax problem, or do we have a government that is, you know, not complying to the Constitution? This stands in the same argument, or the state arguments of people saying your state taxes and the state's out of control. Yeah, it's out of control. But you don't have a tax problem. You have a government problem where they're not doing those things that are enumerated.
Mm-hmm.
So if people just change that one paradigm, if it's not enumerated, you can't do it. Because I deal with people all the time, and they always want to go down this path of conservative and moral. They want the Constitution of the United States to, you know, regulate morality, that, you know, everything has to be biblical, based on biblical. No, it doesn't. As far as for government, I think it should be left to, you know, your, because it always came back when Madison stated, okay, you want it to be biblically based. Okay, so whose Bible are we going to use? And because nobody could come up with a set consensus, but they're really quick to go after those who, you know, are the minority. The minorities are the easy ones to attack. And technically, when you see the government actually being used to attack a minority, then you really have, I mean, this really starts speaking of oppression, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when King George, because the United States didn't attack blacks and basically conscript them to slavery. It wasn't the states. It wasn't the, you know, the Continental Congress. It wasn't the colonies. It was King George that did that. Folks, read Thomas Jefferson's original declaration. He clearly points out how the king was the one that made that call. And it wasn't the original King George. It goes way back. This happened in the 1600s. They wanted to be able to manage and manipulate. By this point in time, the British government became probably one of the most maniacal governments ever, because they learned how to control things. We're running out of time, so tomorrow when we come back, or actually next week when we come back, we will actually discuss which debates and dive into the debates that we're going to cover. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And the folks, I can't emphasize, please reach out. Please start getting involved in a campaign on the Constitution. That's where we win. Every time. Bye now.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.